From Rochester, New York, this is Mad Dog Movies, Episode 2. We now join a conversation between filmmakers Mike Boas and John Vincent, already in progress.
Yeah, I've known you, I don't know, 5-6 years. And
That's too long.
Yeah, really. You were pro-film for a very long time.
I still am pro-film.
But this camera sort of won you over, is that?
Well, it's a matter of being able to do something and not being able to do something.
Right. What's the best tool?
If I had the budget, yeah, I would shoot film. One of my favorite formats is Super 16.
Right.
For a number of reasons.
Which, yeah, I mean, it looks great. You get the Vision 2 stock.
Right. And, I mean, compared, Super 16 compared to the HVX, I mean, Super 16 is still going to blow it out of the water in terms of, you know, when you're shooting at night, picking up details in the shadows, the latitude, which is basically a simplified version of what latitude is the details that show up within a given brightness of the or darkness of the film. You're able to see more detail within the same exposures,
yeah,
within the same lighting conditions.
Yeah, in video, you have a narrower window, basically.
Yeah, so it's a little trickier. It's a lot harder to light for HD to get it to come close to looking like film, and it still doesn't look like film.
But it's, you know, lighting.
If you're shooting a no-budget, which is essentially what we're doing here, you know, our film, Like Midnight, is basically a no-budget. Nobody's really getting paid to work on it. I mean,
Between other no-budget movies and ours, so hopefully, is we got professional people that know.
We have professional because of my contacts, because of you, because of me, because other people that work for me. Because I've been working in the business for ages, and I have people, my crew and stuff. We work on, you know, big, you know, fairly large size professional films, and we're going to do this film ourselves and not take any money for it right off the bat. So we're doing that because we want to start calling our shots and making our own projects.
Right.
And bringing these old style effects into these movies, and we figure if we make them for a certain budget, that we'd be able to at least, you know, make a living at it. You know, I mean, I do believe there's a market out there for seeing a Lovecraft type of story that has some really cool creature effects, a good story.
Yep.
You know, a little TNA, of course,
and a little humor I know writing with you is interesting because. I start out with one idea that it's going to be this serious, scary movie, and you come in with, oh, well, let's put in some jokes here. And I'm like,
they're not jokes.
Yeah, that's
so
the thing. It's not, exactly. It's not.
Because life, as far as I'm concerned, life is not a comedy.
I understand.
And it's not a drama. Yeah. It is somewhere in between. It's a mixture of comedy and drama. I mean, real life is. I mean, you know, it's like my own life. I've had all this tragedy right in the, you know, my father passing away was probably the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. You know, but as my father was dying, we were making jokes about it. I mean, as an example, I mean, we knew my father was going to pass away. We had a good idea he was going to pass away, and we pull out of the driveway. I'm driving. I stop. I pull and get the mail out of the mailbox, and I said, hey, Dad, look, you want $1,000 a week for the rest of your life. So,
how'd he take that?
He laughed.
Yeah, sure,
you know,
you
I mean, but what are you going to do? You know, so, you know,
so within this
I just
movie,
think within the,
we've
the
got
art,
not
my
jokes,
art,
but
you know, I
humor.
Think it's, well, yeah, it's, yeah, you can't have one or the, I just don't think you can have one without the other.
Yeah, well, you read Lovecraft and it's all dirge and sturm
and
drag.
We're doing our own thing based on the Lovecraft mythos with our own injecting our own take on it because it isn't as dark and it isn't quite as depressing as some of the, which some people might not like, but hey.
Well, you always have this problem. You have a problem in almost every horror movie. You got a character put into an extreme situation. Maybe there's like a leap of belief that they have to go through. And how do you address that without, you know, let's say someone doesn't believe in ghosts or they don't believe in vampires.
Which I don't. I don't believe in any
right.
of that stuff.
So you imagine, well, how is someone going to, okay, then you got a vampire in the movie. And you got a vampire that they come across. How do they react to it? How do they make the jump from their rational life to this, okay, now we're in a vampire world. I think of From Dusk Till Dawn. You have this scene in the movie where everyone says, I don't believe in vampires. But that wasn't right.
And well,
they,
I had a, I have a funny
have,
story.
They
about
have to
that,
joke yeah. about it, and it sort of breaks the ice. And it's a little bit of winking to the audience to let them
in. Well, we went to see that. Two of my cousins and I went and saw that film.
Yeah.
My one cousin and I knew the film was a horror film. My other cousin...
Because it's in the commercials.
Well, my other cousin didn't see any of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
He was going to the film, and it starts out as this crime thing, like a Pulp Fiction-ish type of
film. Exactly what they wanted.
And so we're sitting there watching the film, and then all of a sudden, Selma Hayek turns into this demon vampire.
Right.
And my one cousin's like, what the hell is this? And when I get to the movie, she says, what? I had no idea. I'm thinking I'm watching one movie, all of a sudden it turns into something else.
Well, then, did he go along with it? Or was he like, I'm walking out?
He didn't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
He didn't walk out. No, I mean, we had a good time. I mean, like I said, the two of us knew what was going to go on, but he did. But that made it even funnier.
But that was the sort of rub your hands together glee that like Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez had when they probably came up with, let's do this. And we won't tell anyone. It's like Psycho killing off a character halfway through. Like, people won't expect it. It'll be great.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it's a cult favorite now, but I don't think it really did well in the box office because
a lot of film.
The people want to pigeonhole things. And then if they don't fall right into one category, they don't know how to market it. And
you're talking to the distribution companies and the larger and the people to put the films out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a long time ago. Films hadn't, I could say a long time ago, but we're talking in the 70s and into the 80s.
Okay, yeah.
Films were at the theater
much longer
for quite some time, and it took a long time to catch on. I'm trying to think of some of the films that didn't catch on right away.
I'll give you one, Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde, boy, it was tanking, and they took it around from city to city to city to city. This is like 67. And it actually, that was one of those weird
success
stories.
Arthur Penn, right? Penn,
yep,
yeah.
Yep. And then ended up did it win some Academy Awards for the actors? Or,
I don't know. It
certainly got a lot of acclaim once people realized
the editing on that. One of the things that stuck out for me was the editing on that film. And, very Peckinpah-ish, because definitely influenced by Peckinpah. But
I think so.
But that's what happened. Films were made. You would find a distributor.
Yeah, well, it's a different
world.
Would
get into
now.
The theaters. I mean, Night of the Living Dead.
Right, that's one that
is one of the classics.
They finish the movie. They go to take it to the distributor, and it was like same week or same day even that Martin Luther King was shot, and no one wanted to look at a horror movie like that. And that was 68, and then it wasn't until like 71 that it really started being successful through an alternative stream. It wasn't mainstream. It was through Midnight Movies, which doesn't exist anymore. But that was a weird sort of 10-year
But there was these venues
time.
Like Midnight Movies for these films to, The Harder They Fall and Harder They Come.
Eraserhead.
Eraserhead was certainly one of them, and Pink Flamingos. And
that was it's a fun idea to, hey, let's do Midnight Movies again.
Rocky Horror, which I can never get my head around, Rocky Horror.
you got to be, I don't know. It depends on who you're with.
I was with a girl. She was a very nice girl, very, very cute. And the only reason I went to saw that movie is because she was one of the ones that was acting like one of the people on the screen.
Oh, really? So she was a nice girl during the day.
And she dressed up. I forgot the name. The one with the top hat she would dress up.
Right.
With.
It was either Columbia or Magenta. I always kind of two.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's the only reason I went. And everybody's running through the audience and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And I'm like, why am I here?
Yeah.
But when she sat on my lap at the home, it was worth it.
But what I'm saying is that was a really like subversive, like counterculture way to see a movie and way to distribute a movie. And it was like instead of distributing a movie, you're planning sort of a rock show. It's like almost like touring a band.
It's not about the movie at that point.
Yeah, it's about the experience.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing is because of the conglomerates and the models out there right now, you can't really do it. I mean, you can go around to film festivals.
That is a problem. A distribution for independent films is a major issue.
There is the Landmark Theater chain, which is run by Mark Cuban. And he also has the Magnolia Pictures and HDNet, which is sort of a three-prong approach to getting a movie out there. Mm-hmm. Steven Soderbergh, for instance, had Bubble, and there's a couple other movies that would go on HDNet and go to Landmark Theaters and maybe DVD all in the same week. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, hey, why not have just one promotion campaign? And no matter how you can get to see the movie is how you get to see the movie. It's, you know, of course, you got to have someone behind you to sort of help that go through. For us, for, you know, someone doing something low budget, you know, direct to video might be your best option. Or, you know, if you can get someone like Lionsgate to pick you up, you really kind of need, you need a distributor and a major like mm-hmm. infrastructure to actually get onto theater screens.
Yeah. And I mean, theater screens isn't necessarily the, you know, venue for mm-hmm. a lot of the films like what we're doing. The chances of making to a movie screen are, yeah. you know, pretty thin.
Well, even something like Feast or the movies that went under the After Dark label, which yeah. were then piggybacked through Lionsgate, it was just like, you know, a 1 or 2 week engagement and then right. it's done. They didn't want to.
And a lot of times yeah. and now they're releasing DVDs at the same time yeah. that they release in the theater as a marketing thing, just maybe yeah. to get a little interest in the theater. Mm-hmm. Boom, you go and buy the DVD. But I think DVDs is probably the best venue of finding a distribution just, you know, through that and through television, pay-per-view, and the internet, I think, is an up-and-coming. And people, it's weird, cause people are doing stuff on cell phones now, too.
Yeah.
There's content created just to watch on cell phones.
Yeah, that's, well, that's, I keep hearing about that over the last several years. I don't know if it's really taken off or not.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I keep up on these manuals, these HD video yeah. and other things. And I like reading articles about the camera, the HVX 200. That camera is being used for a lot of that type of stuff.
Sure.
You know, and it's all HD.
You know, if you can get money out of it, then people will chase the money. There's also, I mean, you can distribute through YouTube and podcasting and that sort of thing. There's not much money in that yet.
Yeah.
It's more of an advertising thing. You get a sponsor maybe, and you get your money from the sponsor instead of the end consumer.
Yeah, the big thing is to create something that people are going to want to watch. Yeah. And if you create something that people are going to want to watch, mm-hmm. there you'll find a place to put it.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a key thing. You know, I mean, it's, you know, what we're doing. I mean, it's in the horror genre.
Yep.
There is a whole subculture of Lovecraft people, which has kind of a built-in
yeah.
audience, keeping the budget to a very small amount.
These are the things you have to think about ahead of time without being too, you know, you're not selling out to think about the end market.
You can't just go at it as
I'm an artist and whatever I do is right. No,
I mean yeah, this cliche has been used so many times, but it's called show business, not show. Mm-hmm. That you, in order for you to make projects, you have to make money.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a balance between the two. I mean, there's very few people that are able just to make their. I mean, we're not living in Europe.
Yeah,
I mean, we're not the Quay brothers. For those of you who don't know who the Quay brothers are, look them up on the internet. But they're Americans that went to United Kingdom.
Okay.
To do their art, because a lot of that stuff is funded by the government through right. grants, and we don't have that here.
Yeah, you've got some of that in Canada and New Zealand, yeah. but yeah, it's hard to do that here.
Yeah, it is. It's very difficult. It is, you know, I mean, this is capitalism at its finest, mm-hmm. and you are creating a product that you want people to see, so they'll pay, yeah. they'll give you money yeah. for what you've done, and you take that money and you go make more product.
And just to clarify, it's not like we said, hey, look, here's an audience for Lovecraft films. Let's make one for them. It was more like, I mean, I already...
Yeah, we like the stuff.
I was reading the stuff, and through my research, because I wanted to do my own short film a few years ago, I wanted to do my own Lovecraft piece, and I was reading through what other people had done, and I found out, that's where I sort of found the niche. Uh-huh. I'm like, wow, this, you know, these are people that are, you know, interested in more product already. I'm interested in the subject matter. So why not do something that they would, you know, enjoy?
I was never someone who was into the mad slasher movies so much.
Right.
As, you know, as much as I always liked the very creative, story-oriented,
yeah.
creature-oriented type of films.
Me too. I mean, I prefer monster or supernatural you know, sci-fi stuff over, you know, hack and slash.
Yeah,
although I do have a certain place in my heart for the Friday 13th movies, and And, you know, the first Halloween and the first Nightmare.
First Halloween. But if you look at some of those films, they were not as violent and gory as people think, or, you know, remember them as being. I mean, Halloween, I can't remember her, much of anything other than strangling, you know, and there are things like that. But
yeah,
there really
not a lot of groove.
Even
but
the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Right.
You never really saw, you thought you saw
but
stuff.
The filmmaking in that, the editing, and the choice of what you see is actually more intense than just,
it's not a,
if you just had a proscenium, hey, look, I'm going to cut out my guts. You know,
well, a lot of people like to go see the gore, which is fine. I mean, I just, it's not my thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've done it. I've done it in movies. You know, I've worked on films where I've actually had to create that gore. You know, which is, it's easy. It's not really that difficult.
This is funny because I've, you know, the pages of the script that you wrote where you're like, here, check this out. And now we've got characters getting cut up into pieces.
Yeah, but that's it's, the story's not about that.
No,
you're not,
that's true.
You know, I mean, I have nothing against putting that in films and seeing that.
Yeah.
I mean, I love George Romero's films.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't like, you know, at least it wasn't for me. It wasn't like, oh, I can't wait for the next scene for someone to get ripped up.
George must get tired of, I mean, you know, his base level of fans, maybe even the young, you know, the youngest, maybe teenagers, they love, you know, hey, you know, I love when a guy was chewing on the guts, or I love this and I love that. He's like, uh-huh. But that's not the reason he made the movie.
He's got social
commentary going on in most
of
those movies.
Well, these are all tools.
Yeah.
They're all tools used to, you know, tell his story.
I mean, you can have just an amusement park ride of a movie and it'd be a totally fun experience, but it's nice if you have something that's there for the second time you watch it, too.
Right.
That about does it for another episode of Mad Dog Movies. If you'd like to visit us on the interweb, go to maddogmovies.com/podcast. Email us at feedback@maddogmovies.com.
And if you'd like to take a look at our website, philrosefilms.com, you'll be able to see a lot of the visual effects we've done in the past, some of the art department stuff we've done on features, and find out the latest news about films we're working on, like Lake Midnight and other projects. That's philrosefilms, philrosefilms.com.
Music for this episode provided by Keith Handy. Visit him at keithhandy.com. Mad Dog Movies was taped before a live studio audience.